Well, this is August 3rd, 1978. I'm Carl Mosier, and I'm going to visit a little bit for the Oral History Society with Edward M. Mills and Catherine S. Mills, longtime owners and operators of the Mill Valley Record. How long, actually, have you been here? It's
in our 16th year, Carl. We started February 5th, 1963. That's when we took over the paper legally and officially.
Let's see, Catherine, you bought the paper from whom?
Actually, we bought it from Harold Smith, but Tom Collison. Harold Smith had only owned it for a short time, like 6 or 8 months, and he bought it from Tom Collison, so Tom really still carried the paper on it. So it's, wouldn't you say that?
Yes, that's right. The payment paper. It was a payout of about 11 years.
To Tom Collison.
Uh-huh. This reminds me, I wouldn't be surprised if you weren't some of the longest owners in residence we've had on the record.
We think we're the longest, except there were a sister, the Douglas sisters.
The Douglas sisters.
And that's right, I've heard of them, yeah.
And probably no one around Mill Valley now remembers them personally. But they did own the paper for many, many years and ran it very rigidly.
They did. I think they had it, when was it? The 20s and 30s, I guess, because the Drexlers had it in the 40s, didn't they? And then Stan Wilson.
I happen to know about that one. They came here in 1936 and sold out, I think, along about 43, something like that.
The Drexlers?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, uh-huh. Yes.
I think to Wilson.
I believe to Stan Wilson.
I think that's right. Yeah.
He was here a number of years, but nothing like 16.
Yeah.
There was an interim owner, a very colorful man that I knew in New York, Louis Ruppel. Did you know him?
This is beginning to come back as you say that. Yes, yes. He was a slightly controversial person, if I remember correctly.
That's really true. And he was wherever he went. But he was a brilliant man. Mill Valley wasn't his bag at all. He was a big town man.
And he had a different feeling about the town itself. I remember there was some criticism because he didn't even live here.
That's right. He lived, I think, in Greenbrae or someplace like that. No, he was.
But I enjoyed him as a man very, very much. He was a hell of a newspaper man. Very good newspaper man.
He came from big papers in the East.
Yes, and he handled public relations for CBS for years, which was a big job. And he's also editor of Collier's.
I think Tom Collison was also involved with National Magazine, wasn't he?
Yes, he was involved PR with J. Walter Thompson.
Oh.
And actually, I knew Tom, had met him in New York before we ever ran into each other again out here.
When was the record founded?
Right at the turn of the century. Some records show 99 and some show 1900. So it was right in there.
That's interesting because you'd think if anything was pinned down exactly, it would be a newspaper.
I think there were other names. It was not always.
Oh.
I think the Mill Valley Record per se was about 1900. I mean, that mm-hmm. name stems from that. And before that, I think there was another name. There was a paper here, however, before 1900.
It's, you know what that reminds me of is Eastwood versus Mill Valley.
Right.
We even get conflicting reports on that.
That where did it all come from?
Jumps all around on us.
But it was, I just had occasion to look this up the other day. It was adjudicated a newspaper of general circulation in 1951, and that was because of new laws. In the early part of the century, you didn't have to be adjudicated a newspaper of general circulation. so that it, no one got around to that till 1951. But the paper, we have bound volumes going back and to, well, I think our earliest ones are around 1914, 1910. Very fragile condition now. But the library, I think, has all that on microfilm.
Exactly.
Which is a marvelous service.
Yes, and I know people come in and use it, but I think they will a lot more in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a great thing to have.
They're indexing it, too, I believe. I think the library's indexing that.
I know they had that project going at one time.
Which is a marvelous service for everybody.
It's tough work.
It's tough work.
Yeah.
It may have broken down. Well, we'll get back to the record in a few minutes. Let's talk about each of you individually for a little bit. Catherine S. What does the S stand for?
Sherwood. My maiden name was Catherine Sherwood.
Where were you born and raised and so on?
I was born in Omaha, Nebraska, but that was just because the hospital was there. And I grew up in Beatrice, Nebraska. My great-grandfather had homesteaded Nebraska. So we grew up in this small town of Beatrice, and I went to Scripps College in Fairmont. My mother had met Ellen Browning Scripps, who was telling her about her plans for a girls' school, a woman's college. She said, "I don't know whether anybody's going to come." So mother said, "Well, I have two daughters, and they'll come." So that's where I went and had a very happy 4 years there. Then from then, I went back to Beatrice and worked on the Beatrice Times.
How do you spell that, by the way?
It's B-E-A-T-R-I-C-E. Mm-hmm. And usually it's correctly called Beatrice, but the woman for whom it was named called herself Beatrice. So that's how that name stuck, Beatrice McKinney, who was the daughter of one of the early governors.
What class were you a member of at Scripps, by the way?
1939.
Uh-huh. And let's see, you graduated in 39, then what happened?
Then I went back to Beatrice and spent 1 year, 1940, with my father, who was not too well. My mother had died in 1934, and my father had had a heart condition, so I stayed there for a year, and then I got a job, looking for a job, too, but jobs for women in those days in a small town were pretty limited. Because I didn't want to go into secretarial work. And then they started a new paper there, a little daily called the Beatrice Times, and they asked me if I'd take over the women's department. I knew nothing about it, but the editor says, "That doesn't make any difference. I'll tell you what to do, but you know everybody in town." So so I worked there until 1944. Dad died in 44, and I stayed on at the paper until 45. In the
what was his
spring.
Occupation, by the way?
He was a banker. Then I went, we had relatives in the East and in Southport, Connecticut. So my young sister, who is 10 years younger than I, went East, and I started looking for a job in New York just before the war ended. And it was just a series of lucky breaks, but I got a job with Newspaper Enterprise Association. Their woman's editor was going to the hospital with an appendix operation, and they asked me if I could put out the Christmas section, and I said, certainly, not knowing anything about it. But anyhow, that started a long, happy relationship with NEA. And I worked, and then when I was married and children started coming, I retired from full-time, but I continued to write a column for them until 1965, when the pressures of the record and that just were too contrasting, and a national column and a weekly newspaper don't fit.
You didn't really need that then, did you?
No.
Let's back up just a second. When and under what circumstances did you meet your estimable husband who's sitting on my left right here? Don't forget, he can correct you in just a minute.
That was an office romance. He came in after World War II to NEA, to Newspaper Enterprise Association. There are several NEAs in this country, and that's why I just designate our NEA as Newspaper Enterprise Association. He started out on the sports desk, and I was still on the women's desk, so our desks were just across the room. That's how we got acquainted, and ultimately, let's see, how long did we knew each other?
Mostly at the cocktail hour in the afternoon.
Uh-huh.
Everybody went across the street to the fishbowl. And how? When was that, 1947? No.
No, 46 is when I went with NEA.
Yeah, that was when we met.
I was, I'd just come out of the service. I was supposed to get out in 45, and they kept me in for an operation, so I didn't get out till April 46, and I went with NEA in July of 46.
Let's see now. We're down very close to your coming to Mill Valley, so I'll shift over to you in just a minute.
Yeah.
Let's see. Between 40...
we were married
the
in
end
1947.
47.
And then our first child, we have three children, and our first child, a daughter, Meredith, was born in 1949. And then Ned, meanwhile, had shifted into business, and he'll explain this to you, but we were transferred to Chicago in 1952, and our son, Charles, was born there. And then our third child, a daughter, Tyler, was born in Illinois. We actually... we're in Illinois until 1962, from 1952 to 1962, and then moved out here in 1963. So,
well, Ned, let's get back to the beginning on you now for a minute. Where were you born?
I was born in Los Angeles.
You don't say.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I find that unusual.
And went to did all my public school work there, and then my folks sent me to. University of Richmond in Virginia. My brother and I, up until that time, were the only ones in the either side of the family that had ever been born outside of Virginia, which was that didn't set too well with a lot of the family.
No, that would be odd. Does your family go all the way back to the Civil War and before?
And before.
Uh-huh.
It's, they have, the Virginians are very proud of being Virginians, and they have what they call the FFV, the First Families of Virginia. And my aunt and uncles have always claimed that they were a part of that. And my grandfather, Tyler, his last name is Tyler, that's our younger daughter's middle name, and we call her that, Tyler. She's actually Catherine Tyler, but she likes Tyler.
It's distinctive and different.
Yes, it is. And it's confusing, too, because no one without seeing her knows whether she's a boy or a girl. As a matter of fact, one of her cousins is a boy named Tyler.
It's particularly confusing now when people have trouble distinguishing between males and females
anyway.
Exactly.
Not at our age, mind you, but the young ones.
She was a very rambunctious little girl, and it came very easy to call her Terrible Tyler. So that's how...
That's right.
Well, I knew her around town here for a number of years. And,
she used to come and buy her shoes from you.
Found her to be an extraordinarily engaging, nice young lady.
She is, and now she's the same description as a young woman.
Great, great.
Very true.
Yeah.
Then, to carry on, I went with the... I finished university in 37 and went right with the newspaper there.
At the Richmond?
The Richmond Newsletter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And before I went into the service, they merged with... Well, they bought the morning paper, and it's now the Newsletter and the Times-Dispatch owned by the Bryant family.
Isn't there a famous Richmond editor by the name of Freeman?
Yes, his name is Douglas Southall Freeman, and our family is related to Inez, his wife, who died 2 years ago, I guess. And we were very close to the Freeman family, but not Douglas Southall. He was a loner all the way. He did the Lee volumes and was doing the... I think there were 5 volumes to Robert E. Lee. And wasn't that... Is that right? 5?
I think so. A monumental classic work, no question about
that. He was about to complete a volume on Washington when he died very suddenly of a heart attack.
I can believe that he was a loner when you consider the amount of work.
He also was the editor of the Newsletter. until what's his name? Kilpatrick succeeded him. The guy that's on, he's on one of the
various programs.
Yes,
as a matter
right,
of fact,
right,
yeah.
What's his first name?
James.
Known as Jack, I think.
Jack,
yeah, on the air.
On Jack, yeah.
I think
yeah.
it is right, yeah, yeah. And then I stayed with them five years, just almost to the day, and then went into the service. The war was on, and I knew I was going to be drafted, but I didn't want to be drafted, so I volunteered. Gave me a different serial number, which I always held with pride. And then, as I said earlier, I went with NEA, and that was it.
What, were you in Army, Navy?
Was the Air Corps then.
Uh-huh.
Now they call the Air Force, it's a separate. The reason they changed the name was to make it an entity of their own.
Mm-hmm.
So the Air Corps was under the Army, which was very, very, it wasn't a happy situation. Because lots of the old Army always figured the Air Corps as kind of a flyboys and not very disciplined. Well, maybe you had some...
I wasn't in the Air Corps, no. Always considered kind of an elite group, and the others, I think, were kind of jealous in a sense, or envious or something.
I would accept it.
Were you in the U.S., or did you...
Catherine laughs at this, but I spent the tough duty of 3.5 years in Trinidad as a first sergeant.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You got used to the climate in that long a time, didn't you?
And it was I certainly did. It was a completely black island, with the exception of some of the Britons that ruled it. But it was a laborious duty to a lot of guys. I was pretty active, but all we did was service airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the outfit was a mechanic. Mm-hmm. With the exception of the housekeeping people, clerks, that kind of staff.
Gave you a lot of time to pick up some of the music. Trinidad
yeah.
is famous for what?
Belafonte was there when he did Rum and Coca-Cola.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm. We used to see him come out to the...
I'll be there.
He was a real young boy then, and young
yeah.
man.
Yeah.
And the calypso music was just beginning to take over.
Right.
Of course, now it's very big. And then I did my duty there and came and then went with NEA. I switched over to business.
I was going to ask about that.
About 49. Well, about 50, wasn't it?
Was
50,
early,
50,
yeah.
no. So what we did, we had counterpart jobs. Catherine was the assistant to the women's editor, and I was assistant to the sports editor. In New York, this was before TV took hold, the press was in very high esteem, and we were invited to lots and lots of functions, cocktail parties, plays, shows, and we decided to take advantage of that. We got invitations to all of them, and we decided to take advantage of that for at least the first year of our marriage. And so we had a plan kids, all right, and had a lot of fun, decided to have the kids come on and after a year, and that's what happened.
That's an experience that no longer
yeah.
exists in
then
that
no,
form, I would
no,
think.
No, it doesn't. Those are the days before you had qualms about accepting freebies and all that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now that really is out now. But
some of it goes on, but they've cut it way
I
back.
Think that goes on probably in New York all the time, because every time something's introduced, they have, it's a pattern. But in those days, it was much more relaxed and kind of easygoing. I think today is probably more frenetic and high-keyed.
Have you been to New York recently enough to know
no.
how the atmosphere has changed?
No, I haven't.
No, I either.
You'd have to stick around a while anyway.
You'd have
wouldn't
to stick
you?
Around.
We have no reason to go back quite that far. We had a son that just a year ago graduated from law at Georgetown. and we went back there for the graduation, and then took that opportunity and traveled down to Virginia and saw some of our relatives, old friends.
I'd like to go back to New York again just to see how it's changed, because it was, we lived in Brooklyn Heights when we were there, and I loved that section. And that has done nothing but go up, up, up in price and esteem, I gather.
It's just right across the river.
But it's a beautiful, you've been there, haven't you, Carl?
I've been in New York, but I'm not familiar with that particular
Brooklyn
spot.
Brooklyn Heights is right across the Brooklyn Bridge.
Oh.
And it was a wonderful Sunday walk across the bridge and down through lower Manhattan. But our friends who've been there tell me that you wouldn't do that now. And they said we use the subways all the time, and that there is, you know, they're not as clean anymore, and they're, it's just kind of gone down at the heels.
Well, San Francisco is having that same experience. We used to, years ago, walk from the press club, which we liked very much, and used very much. Well, we used it pretty much. And we'd walk over to Fisherman's Wharf or North Beach and think nothing of it at night. We wouldn't do that now.
Afraid not, or at least you wouldn't want to do it at night.
No.
And the same thing is true in most metropolitan areas, though it may be more exaggerated here in New York than some places.
It's a sad commentary on our culture.
So?
It really is.
Let's see now. You were getting into business a minute ago, and then we slipped back a little bit. How did that occur?
Well, I went into the business side, which is in the beginning mostly sales, of selling the service to newspapers. And I traveled the all of New England and all of the East Coast down as far as South Carolina. I had North Carolina and went all the way to Massachusetts.
And are you servicing old accounts or getting new ones?
Both. Uh-huh. Calling on, keeping the association going, the relationship between the client and the corporation. And getting new clients. And new clients is where, of course, a salesman makes his money. And I had a degree of success in it. And because of that, I was a number two man in the New York area. It was a man over me. And they gave me the Midwest section, which I ran myself for 10 years. Before we bought the paper here.
Might be worth it. Footnote, the Newspaper Enterprise Association is a member of the Scripps Howard Group, and it services, it has a vast amount of, not vast amount, but it has a lot, it's a feature service, and it does have many, many clients, into the hundreds of clients around the country. But you don't see it here very much. In fact, I don't think, the Independent Journal used to take it, but I don't know whether they do anymore or not. But you're not aware of it here as much as you are in the other parts of the country.
One of the setbacks, well, it wasn't a setback, but one of the hurdles of Newspaper Enterprise was their policy of selling their features as a package. You couldn't buy a hot item out of it. You had to take everything.
And that didn't mean you had to print it.
It didn't mean you had to print it, but you had to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no a la carte buying or a la carte selling.
Mm-hmm.
And this was... This wasn't happy with a lot of editors or publishers. They have, since I left, relaxed that. They haven't done it completely, but they're a big paper can buy certain things out of it now. I notice every once in a while there'll be an NEA feature in a Chronicle.
And by buying parts of it, you mean they might buy... might say, well, we can use sports, but we don't want foreign affairs.
You're right, exactly. And that you could not do.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with comics. We had a big stable of comics. Good ones, too. But you couldn't buy one.
Where was your headquarters operation in the West?
The headquarters, it was a dual proposition. The president at one time, for years, was in Cleveland. Well, one was in New York, and then... The first vice president was in Cleveland. Cleveland did most of the printing, the physical work of the synagogue. In those days, it were mats. Now everything is cold type, which is a photo operation now. It's what they call slicks. Then it has bounced back and forth. Whoever the president that going through two or three now wanted to be is where the headquarters was. And it's gone back between Cleveland and New York. It's now in New York again. There was a president that was president for many, many years. What was Fergie? About 30 years president, possibly more. Great, a dynamic man, and about the tallest 5'6" man I ever knew. And he ran it, and man, and he's the one that put me in on the business side. He thought that, he liked the way I operated, I guess, because we got along really well.
Did you move directly from that into the Mill Valley record?
Yes, we did. I was out of work for about 6 months. There was a power struggle within NEA, and I was shooting for the presidency, and I lost it, and they paid me off quite handsomely. The way the thing got down to the end, one of us had to go. And if I'd have won, the other man.
That sounds a little like advertising agencies, which do things rather similarly.
It did, almost the same. As a matter of fact, most of the fellows in the business side were almost, they could have handled advertising very easily. They just happened to be in a selling them. A different art.
Mm-hmm. So then, who first had the idea of getting a small town newspaper,
Toyed with it for several years.
For many years. Ned was had been on the road, and it gets to be a very wearisome thing.
Okay.
And we had talked for a long time about trying to find a paper, and we ran into the problem at that time was that many of the small papers in the Midwest, or where we could find them, that you could afford, were grabbed up by large publishers for their sons to get indoctrinated into the business on a lower level. So that we actually came very close to getting the paper in Gallipolis, Ohio. And that was, that's right on the Ohio River, and we were right in the midst of negotiation with Mr. Deer, when he died, and his sons decided that they didn't want to sell after all. So then we started going further afield, and Ned actually came out to California.
The way you buy a paper is through a broker usually, unless you have some contact with in some of the associations like California Newspaper Association. Meet guys at their meetings. They'll say, "Well,
I've got a hot one for
you." Yeah, that
kind
of thing. But for most people that aren't in that thing, which we are now, of course, and we weren't at that time, you go through a broker, and this broker, I had answered an advertisement, and. It was in Soledad, California, and I flew out, and he showed me the paper, and then I stayed a couple of days and looked over the town, and I guess one day it was. And so I said, "Joe, this maybe I could hack it out here, but I don't think Catherine would like Soledad. Have you ever been to Soledad?"
I was just trying to think when you asked that question. Well, the name is so familiar.
It's a prison town.
It's a prison town. You can ride by it on the way south on 101.
To Carmel.
That's why I remember.
Yeah, it's very close to Salinas.
Not to Carmel, on the way to San Luis.
It's the problem with it. Yeah. It was today we could probably handle it, but in those days you had three young children all in school, and Soledad is primarily Mexican town with you know, that's not bad, but it does mean that there's the schools may not be just as good as you'd like for your children. And that
our kids were all growing up then.
And they were
lots going back to 16 years.
It's a
isn't
pretty
there a lot
bleak.
Of truck gardening
yes.
there?
Yes, sir.
And
I
it's
think.
A bleak town, mm-hmm. too. It's a little flat.
Yeah, that's the perfect word.
Yeah.
As I recall from driving through,
right.
It's indeed very bleak.
So I told Joe that wasn't for me. I said, I'll catch the airplane back and maybe he'll run into something else. He said, well, I've got one that's in flux now. He said, I don't know whether it's really for sale, but I just sold it about 8 months ago. And the new owner is not happy with the situation. And he says, you want to go down and look at it? I said, where? He says, Mill Valley. Well, I had never been to Mill Valley, ever. So he did. He brought me here, and we got here about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and he took me all over the area. Well, he doesn't take a salesman to sell Mill Valley Beauty.
Particularly if you've just been in Sullivan.
That's right. Exactly.
Right, there is a difference.
So I said, see if it's for sale. And he took me. This isn't always true at all, but mostly if the paper's for sale, they're not in the black very far and mostly in the red. And what you try to do is to figure what the potential is. And that's what we did do, and I got on the phone to Catherine and she flew right out, looked at the paper. We were then at that time right across from the post office.
No,
the
City Hall.
The City Hall, next to the post office, which is now the annex. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 21 Corte Madera, which is where the Pacific Sun is now.
And we came to some terms. We thought we could pack it, and so we did. That's what we did.
And you obviously have. You just remind me of a question, though. There was a belief about town going back all the way to the year, whenever it was, that Stan Wilson disposed of the record.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow or other, they'd gotten the price jacked up so high, so inflated, that everybody after that had a terrific time trying to stay in the black. In other words, they were paying too much for it.
I think that's true.
I think that's true.
We tried to get the price down naturally, and we're not successful. But we thought I told the family this story, and then when I was on the road for NEA, I went to Honolulu, and our client was a big paper there. I was talking to them, and this was in 1960, and the editor was telling me, I said, it looks like a lot of Chinese and Japanese owners over here, everything. And it was true. And he said, you know why that is, don't you? And I said, no, I don't. So right after the war, the Chinese were buying up Honolulu. They saw the, particularly when it became a part of the States. He said, the American would come over and say, well, what do you want for this property, and what do you want for this store? And the owner would tell him, and he said, well, I'll be back. I've got to talk to my people in the States. And he'd come back and he'd, well, it's sold. The Chinaman bought it. And so Howard Chapin told me, he said, but the Chinaman, if he thinks he can make it, he doesn't care what the price is. And he said, he's not going to bargain or anything else. So I said, our boy, Charles Wolf, are you going to buy it like the Chinaman buys it? And I said, that's what we're going to do.
And it was inflated. There's no question about it. But if you can hang in there long enough, and of course, mm-hmm. Ned is a salesman and doesn't understand sales, and he was able to build up the business side of it. You know, this is one place where some of the former owners were a little weak. They were very. They may have been strong editorially, but they didn't have the know-how mm-hmm. to get Well, Ned got all the markets in there for one thing, and we hope there won't be a United Grocery strike. But it did take an awful. It took a time and a lot of hard work.
I think a factor that should not be overlooked, Carl, is that the editorial product, of which Catherine is in complete control, has been good. And if you have that,
and improved a lot in the last few years, mm-hmm. No question about it.
Well, we think so, and I'm glad that you think so too. And if you have that kind of product, well, the other things fit in together, but you can't sell a bad product.
Well, and circulation is a factor too.
But you have the circulation if you have the product.
Well, not only with the record, but with the shopper. I mean, when you can tell an advertiser you're going to get saturation coverage in Southern Marin, and we have always, people have fool around with their circulation figures, as I'm sure you're aware. But the one thing that we've been able to do, because we do mail the thing, is that we can show them the postal statements, and we're paying for something. That is the coverage, and it's
our combined is about 20,000 now, 20,000 plus.
That sounds very impressive to someone who doesn't know anything about it.
Well, it is.
And somebody has to pick it up because it's in the mailbox.
I bet. Oh, yes, that would tie the figures down, I should think.
Yeah, it does tie them down. And then now we're audited and all that. But I think a combination. I mean, the circulation is certainly an appealing pitch to the advertiser, too.
What do you think about this new business of newspapers consolidating? I know there's a lot of concern in the land about that, and I'd love to hear what you both have to say about that.
I think it's inevitable, Carl. I don't particularly like it. But what has happened, and the ones that I've been familiar with, I'm talking about consolidation, that the corporation or the owner has really left a local editorial control to the local managers. When they buy a paper, they're not all that philanthropic. They're out to make money. And who wins an election or just how the school board operates, the corporation doesn't really care. Now, locally, to do. See, as you know from our paper, we cover almost every little thing that happens in this town because we care about it. And that's the way most small papers do, and larger ones too that are members of corporations. Now, whether that's violated, that policy is violated, occasionally I don't know.
Well, I feel somewhat differently than Ned about that. I think consolidation of some functions is probably okay, particularly in small papers where your costs now are so high in terms of production. Well, consolidating a central printing plant, for instance, that's not owned by a newspaper, but you take your paper there, and that's what we're doing now, for example. So your paper is printed there, but I think it's inevitable that if you have consolidations of large conglomerates taking over newspapers, you're going to get a lesser of an editorial product, because I think there is a corporate point of view that's not going to be so gung-ho about investigative journalism. On a small town paper like Mill Valley Record, there isn't an awful lot of investigative journalism available because we run a pretty open, clean town. In fact, several years ago, a young reporter came in and wanted to do some investigative journalism for us, and we said, you know, all right, what do you want to investigate? And there really wasn't very much. He thought health food stores. Well, he couldn't even find out, you know, much to investigate about health food stores. A small paper has a different problem than a metropolitan. And I see consolidation of functions of production facilities is feasible, but editorial, I would be opposed to.
We we cover and watch the city government and all of its functions just as close as we possibly can. And we just have seen no evidence of graft or corruption or any of the things that, that turn up in a big city.
Well, the possibilities are relatively limited,
yeah.
I suppose, too, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Well, the exposure, everybody's looking at you.
Yeah, right. They may be guilty of atrocious judgment or
yes,
something,
that's
but there's
right.
nothing crooked yeah. about it.
That's true.
But it's the editorial, lumping of editorial ideas without any opposition in these various cities that worries people.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think there's reason to be worried.
It can be very debilitating, yeah. I would think. I noticed, speaking of different points of view, that something unique happens in the case of you two. That you often have different points of view, and you say we disagree on something, and here's what I think, and then the other one of you will come on and say, this is what I think. I've never seen that before, really, in this type of operation.
That observation's been made by others, too, but I didn't know that. Because it's just the way we've always been.
Why should you, why should you back off an idea just for the sake of unanimity?
Well, family unanimity is, for the public, is kind of a recognized phenomenon.
Right.
But I guess anyone who knows you knows that it's an intellectual exercise and you're not fighting.
We're not.
No, not at all. No, not at all.
No, we don't.
And sometimes it's been hard to disagree because the candidates, we have mostly where we disagree is on candidates or on issues. Mostly candidates. And the selection is very hard to make because we have some very fine candidates, I think, in the whole spectrum, locally, state, national is a different thing, although we do take a position on all elections.
Have you been pressured by politicians, really, at any time?
I don't know how to interpret pressure.
Not pressure.
Well, I suppose when they run advertisements at election time.
That doesn't mean that. That does not affect our.
It doesn't.
No, not at all.
We get.
We don't handle it. We let the advertising manager handle it. Or the girls mm-hmm. up front when they come in.
And there's no effort to try and coerce you into editorializing for a person?
What they do is call on you mm-hmm. and ask for your support, yes.
Fair enough.
Yeah, sure.
That's right.
And then we ask why they're running, what are their qualifications and background. Most of them we know already. I don't think it's surprisingly, but I would guess that the editorial support of a paper doesn't mean a whole lot to the average voter.
Well, it's obviously very different than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
We're all bombarded with information now.
A man can make up his own.
We used to be relatively dependent on papers. We're all three old enough to remember that.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
You don't feel, as editor of the paper, that you're being pressured at any time?
No, because, Carl, as you say, we're all old enough. Maybe if I were 20 or 30 years younger, I would feel pressured, but I don't feel pressured now.
Also,
when you've been through it time mm-hmm. after time after time, you can almost tell who's going to come on strong. They're one city council candidate. Who did win without our support did do a lot of pressuring and we just didn't think he was a good candidate and weren't going to support him for anything. And he ran and he won. And so,
did you actually oppose him or did you just keep quiet?
No. This is.
You can tell who we're against by whom we're for.
Mm-hmm. Sure. The other side of the coin.
Yeah.
No, we don't slug anybody at all. But in this area where you talk about pressure, the longer you're in this business and the older you get, the thicker your skin gets.
Yeah.
So that it's not a so what thing, but you don't.
It finally reaches the so what else is new.
Yeah,
yeah.
Area.
You don't go home and bite your nails or stay awake at night.
Yeah.
The hard thing is between when you have three candidates running for two seats and you know that all three of them are pretty good people, then it becomes mm-hmm. a real hard decision.
That's right.
To make. And we've had that situation a couple of times.
The business of paper is always supporting some kind of a slate and so on. Has a long tradition in this country.
It does. Yeah. It does. And maybe it's a faulty tradition, too. I mean, maybe there are three candidates, but you always are going to have to fill two seats, you know, or whatever. And if you, so you have to make some kind of a decision. As I say, it doesn't always mean much.
Up until now, the big issue of city council in the elections has not been the candidate himself, but the city manager. And it was Armkrantz was controversial. Bonner was controversial.
I hadn't thought of it that way. You're
Cunningham
right.
was
You're
controversial.
Right. Yeah.
Usher left. And, of course, Hazen came in, and uh-huh. it seems to be a very popular city manager.
Yeah, but he's also controversial
he's also
now
controversial.
And getting increasingly so, I think. How do you account for that? Or is that a commonplace in small towns?
Well, it's been commonplace here. But I don't know the other towns. Well, city managers bounce around and they always land on their feet, too, pretty much, if they want to continue.
That's true. I guess Bert Ballmer, I remember very well.
Yes.
Was he here when you brought the paper?
No. Armkrantz was the city manager.
And Armkrantz was controversial. Our own feelings on the matter, excluding the current city manager, who I happen to think is doing a pretty good job, is 2 years is all. Of course, they don't last too much more than that.
No, that's about par, I think.
Right.
We thought Bert Ballmer did a lot for the town. He did lots of ecological, and also park and rec became a very big thing under Ballmer, which this town needed, and we hope continues to have a good department. And then the others were so.
Well, they're all good people.
Yes,
for the most part. It's a position where their person, their personality, and their views on every subject are exposed constantly.
Constantly,
yes,
right.
So it is pretty hard, I imagine, to
I think it
go. Huh. Did you both see the controversial picture that appeared on television nights ago?
I saw it in Salina, Kansas.
You don't say.
We were taking, I was taking our daughter to Memphis, who's moving there to live and work.
Uh-huh.
And she wanted to have somebody with her, and we did too. Mm-hmm. So I drove with her in a little Pinto, which is knees to chin all the way.
Yeah, through the hot.
Have you gotten the kinks out yet?
Just about now. And so I saw it there, and we were very disappointed.
Did you pick up any comments in Kansas on it?
I did, from the hotel owner in the morning when I was checking out. And she said, is that the way your place is? And I said, there might be about 8% of it, but that would be a high count, I think. I said, they took all the negative things. And our daughter, who just loves Mill Valley, the one's in San Luis Obispo now, finishing Cal Poly, she grew up on horses in all this beautiful country. They didn't even mention Tam, Mount Tam, or any of the nice things. Which the thing about it, and I know how these guys care and operate, they don't care about how controversial it was. They want the numbers, the rating, and I'm mm-hmm. sure it got high rating.
Of course, it was a feature article, and just picked out the most sensational area and focused right in on it.
You know, the kind of thing that they did on there wouldn't even make a story in our paper. you know, it's a so what thing again.
Yeah, well, partly familiarity.
Well, that's right, yeah.
I don't know.
We know it goes on, sure, but yeah. Not to the extent that...
You said 8% maybe. I've heard estimates running from roughly that up to 15 is absolute tops.
Yeah.
And beyond that, it's relatively unknown society that
that's
you're talking about.
That's right.
What's your general view of it, Catherine?
Oh, I thought it was distorted. And again, I felt that he took... they were looking for something sensational. Marin County, rightly or wrongly, has a certain reputation that's built up through the 60s. Mm-hmm. Around the country, and they came in looking for something to substantiate the serial, you know, Cyrus McFadden's book, the thing that's too bad is that she really wrote a satire, and what they did is give it the leaden treatment of absolute fact, and it isn't fact, and I felt it was very distorted, and I do think that they missed a lot of the positive things about Marin that makes it a beautiful place that everybody wants to come to.
I wonder if the peacock ever thought his feathers were going to be this popular or exploitable.
Or, right, yeah.
Well, I must say it's getting enormous publicity yardage.
It is,
oh, yeah.
It is.
In every conceivable way. I wish they'd forget the whole thing.
I
frankly,
do too.
Why?
I just drop it down.
Carl,
right.
What was your reaction to it?
Oh, I guess it relates to what you were saying a while ago, Ned. I've lived a long time, and I've seen things like this come and go so many times that I just laugh at it. First, I was on downtown on the square for almost 30 years, so I was familiar with this starting maybe 10 or 12 years ago,
mm-hmm.
This general scene that they're talking about.
Yeah.
It's here all right, but it does represent a small percentage, as you say. One of the things that is most notable about it, to me, fact that this whole subculture is, on the whole, humorless.
That's true.
They're deadly serious and have very little humor.
That's true. And that came out in Sarah McFadden's book.
Yes, you're right.
It just absolutely...
And this should have been talked about a bit more. And also, we're getting a totally humorless response from a lot of people now.
That's true, too.
Which tells us a lot about them, just between the three of us.
Yeah, right.
You know, something else about it that I'd like to have you comment on. I know that drug activity in Marin County has been extraordinarily large, and I know it's on prominent all over the country, but very noticeable here in so many different ways. They didn't touch on that hardly at all, except for one little shot in a few words. What was your, did that strike you at all, that omission?
No, it didn't. It did not.
That's interesting.
It is very interesting. For some reason, and I don't know why it is, whether we isolate ourselves and our work so closely or intently, but I'm not conscious of the drug scene. See, our kids never experienced it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I have.
Well, we certainly experienced it. I mean,
in the 60s,
were well aware of the drug activity,
sure.
In the 60s, but I think today it's kind of gone underground, and I imagine one reason they probably couldn't get a drug dealer to come forward and say this is the life. But
well, they did mention it at McDonald's.
Yes, right.
At McDonald's, yeah.
Uh-huh.
But they, didn't, and they could do. Now there is something that you could do a much more detailed, much yes, because my understanding is that it's the drug dealing is tremendous here.
We have quite a reputation in that regard.
Yeah,
as a matter of fact, I don't know whether it's deserved or not.
Well,
to the extent we hear about it.
The suspicion is that a lot of these Mercedes aren't the product of legitimate businesses.
Right.
I dare say that's true. You must have had some interesting high spots in these 16 years, because people in a paper of this sort, in a town this size, are themselves exposed quite a deal. I'd love to hear each of you comment on something that comes to mind. It's interesting.
Who's first? I think one of the things I'd like to get into the record here is our change. One of the things that was exciting to us personally is the change in our production methods. When we bought the paper in 1963, it was in that building at 21 Court of Madera, and the Masonic Hall had grown up around it, and the press had actually been, it was an old flatbed press, and I think it had, an 8-page capacity.
Right.
And it was forever breaking down, and then you get the welder in there in the middle of the night to weld it back together again. And we began to grow and decided that when did we move to 78 East Blythedale?
I'm not sure.
But it was a move from, we had to break up the old flatbed, but we bought a rotary press.
66,
in
I think.
And one of the marvelous sights, we had a picture of it in the paper, but when they pulled out the old linotypes, they mounted them on a great big flatbed truck in front of the Mill Valley Market, and to see them going down, they looked just exactly like dowagers going into the opera. Great, bosomed linotypes sailing down
what
the
happened
street.
To them, literally?
Well, what happened to them now, when we stayed in hot, that's the hot type method of printing, in the molten lead, that gradually became obsolete. So what happened is that we have farmed out our production now, and it's a cold type operation.
Year ago last March.
Its readability has improved.
Right. Yes, 1,000%.
Yeah.
Whatever
really.
High number you could put.
Any number you can think of.
The reason we couldn't do it sooner is that we inherited a union shop. And if we had changed from hot type to cold type, we would have had to maintain a union shop. And whether you argue pros or cons of unionism, it's a very difficult thing for a small paper to meet the demands of a metropolitan union, and particularly in a county where no one else is. You see, we were the last of the union shops. Hmm. But anyhow, so...
No, next to last.
Next,
Novato was...
Novato, right. Novato's still...
No, they're
out.
They're out now, but they were still union when we...
But the Marin Suburban papers then got some big equipment so that they could actually handle more production than they were currently doing. And it was that, and we parted amicably from the union, but it was by farming it out we were able to. So we're now coal type. So we've seen the shift from the old primitive flatbed to offset.
Now, were you able to sell the flatbed, or is it
the flatbed junked? Was junked. The big rotary press is still in position at our old print shop on 78 East Blythedale on the back there. The artist that took over what had been our print shop fell in love with the press, so they left it there as an artifact, which was fine. And they kept one of the linotypes.
And it was unsaleable. You couldn't sell it.
You couldn't. There's just no...
Except for junk.
Strictly a museum item.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And they cleaned the brass up, and it's a beautiful, piece of equipment.
Well, it works like a sewing machine.
Great stuff. Yeah.
And they also kept one of the linotypes as an artifact. But
there was a little background on that.
Which part of it?
On the why the press was left there.
Oh, uh-huh.
It's true they did want it, but in that kind of press, which is not true with the offset press, you have a pit, and it's a very deep pit, and about 6 feet, so over 6 feet. A man can stand in there and lubricate and fix the gears and that kind of thing from underneath. Well, if we took that press out of there, there was some discussion with the landlord as who was going to fill that pit. And you know what it cost to fill that pit? $10,000.
Oh, you jest.
No.
It's about 10 feet deep and about 18 feet long.
I would have filled it for much less than that.
Well, that's a lot of a pit. That's a lot of hole.
Why couldn't he just grease his car there? And
right.
Well, the landlord happened to be a woman. Well, anyway, that's the way we resolved it for a dollar paper exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Catherine did gloss over, I think, the severance with the union. That happened after hours and hours of negotiation and dreary. I don't happen to be anti-union, but we're glad that the thing turned out the way it has.
Had all the other papers who had gotten away from the union gone through the same sort of thing?
They had, as you probably recall, Carl, the IJ situation.
Mm-hmm. That desperate strike they had.
Yes, and strike. Very violent. And they, of course, we in the business called, use the phrase breaking the union, which is a bad phrase. It shouldn't be used. But they did relieve themselves of the union. And if they hadn't, and we're not kidding ourselves, if that hadn't happened, we probably would still be union. But with that terrible experience, a man was murdered.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then lots of other unpleasant things happened. They didn't want any more of Moret. So they let us out.
They let us out.
And we only had three men. I thought it was amusing. I'm taking up too much of your time.
Not at all. That's very interesting historical material.
They sent a man, when we were getting up the nitty-gritty, they didn't want us to leave. They wanted to keep those three men. And they did slow down. And you can't prove a slow down, but we could see it. Did everything. Well, they sent them, and we wouldn't give in to their demands. Their demands were really pretty heavy for our pay. So they sent the head man from New York out. And we had a meeting at the press club. There were three of them, two of us. Catherine was in on all the negotiations and a very good negotiator.
So, and you're still just talking about those three men in Little
Mill
Valley.
But here's what happened. The number of men didn't come in to the conversation. We were talking about different paragraphs. Welfare.
The man's name is Mr. Borrows.
Right, and it's easy to remember because of Boris Karloff, of course. But the thing was right in the middle of the negotiation, and Catherine finally said, "Oh, Mr. Borrows, do you know how many men we're talking about?" And he said, "No." She said, "Three."
And he looked at the president of the local 21, and he looked this way, and he looked that way, and he said, "Three." And he said, "Well, I didn't come out here just to see the Mill Valley Record. I'm also out here to see the San Jose Mercury News."
Which I think was an afterthought.
A few more than three.
Oh,
you think
that
was...
Yeah, he just said
that was a face saver, huh?
Yeah.
But
and it was at that point that it really kind of...
everything.
And we made a settlement.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And they were happy with it, and we were happy with it, and we shook hands and moved out. And I've been very happy with our present arrangement. And as you mentioned, particularly that product.
The product.
You know, it got to a point, Carl, that if I knew the guy's picture was going to be in the paper and I saw him come down the street, I'd duck. Because I knew it wasn't going to. It looked like black. Just terrible.
Well, maybe it was so bad that no one could identify him, so it didn't matter. You'd gone full circle.
I think certainly one of the most interesting times, no matter where you live, but on a paper it was very interesting, was the late 60s here in Mill Valley, and the parade of people that came in before my startled Midwestern gaze. Do you remember the... Well, Leonard Anderson was with us at that time, and he had quite good rapport with most of the subculture in the Mill Valley. So we had people I just had never seen the likes of before, and some very pathetic, lots of pathetic young people. It just touched me deeply. They just didn't seem to know where they were going or what they were going to do. And we were active in the community, in the Episcopal Church, with the housing and food gathering and all those things that, what was the name of the place? They met at the community church, but we had one night down there to bring food. Remember those? Not community,
the Methodist church, that sort of
yeah, where they were.
It was kind of like a halfway house,
right?
Sort of a youth, broken down youth hostel arrangement.
Right, and it worked all right for a while, except, and all of us with the best will in the world were taking large pots of food down there, and then the van people got wind of it, and they just pulled their vans in there with their little families and all that, and here's a free meal and a place to sleep overnight. So that, you know, robbed it of its meaning, because they weren't really there to service a family. But anyhow, those were exciting times.
Carl, during that same era, there was, you may recall, up over our building at 780 Blythedale was a Sun Dancer. They sold beads and lots of little trinkets that kids and older kids were buying. But also there, we suspected that there was dope being. Kids would come in there by the drove.
And cars from out of state stopped there. 10 minutes later, they'd be off again.
And big cars. So I went to Dan. I said, Dan, gee, you got to find out something for us. Right? I said, I don't want some big investigation scandal break right over the paper and we don't even know about it.
You're talking about Terzi's, the chief of police.
Yeah, right. Dan, right, yeah. Exactly. And with whom we're very close. He put undercover men on it, and they couldn't find anything. And finally, I said, Dan, and what they were doing is smoking this incense all the time, which was, I thought, a cover-up for the pot.
Or worse.
Yeah, or, yeah, it can be worse, exactly. So O'Connor was the head of the state investigation, Irishman over in the real good investigator in the city, and Dan brought him over with his undercover man, and they never did find anything. And then, of course, the 60s faded away, and nothing happened. But I was always apprehensive of that the Chronicle might come over here, or even worse, one of the television media, and break the whole thing right over, literally over our head.
That would be professionally embarrassing, among other things.
The most logical suspicion we heard was that they were not dealing in dope there, but that they may have had information as to where you could go. Because there was just too much coincidence in running up and down those stairs, just hordes of people. And they can't all be buying beads, you know, although a lot of them were.
Well, they may have been setting up drops in various places, as you suggest.
The manager at that time, coincidentally, his name was Wolf.
I don't know what's ever happened to Wolf either. No.
He wasn't in sheep's clothing. He was more like beads, you might say.
Well, Carl, does that touch all the bases?
Oh, I'd love to hear some more stories like that for just a few minutes here. We'll run out this side, or approximately that.
Well, I'll tell you one that happened in our own little office. When Leonard Anderson was our managing editor, and he was in full swing in the late 60s, you know, that time in there. And he's a blonde. And he's not blonde. He's reddish, kind of reddish blonde. And he started letting his hair grow, and he let it, and it's, you know, and then he's the kind that shouldn't really have a mustache or a beard because it's not heavy enough, but these little sparse hairs began to appear. And our advertising manager said, Catherine, when are you going to tell him to cut his hair? And Ned would say, when are you going to tell him to cut his hair? And it was getting longer and longer and longer. I said, I'm never going to tell him to cut his hair because I don't care whether it goes down to his knees as long as he's doing a good job. And
he did do a good job.
And that's all I care. Well, one day, this went on for months, and it got shaggier and, you know, kind of ghastly looking. And then one day he came in and nobody said anything. And he said, Jesus Christ, isn't anybody going to say anything? And so Ned kind of looked at him, and Bob kind of looked at him. He said, I had my hair cut, and nobody noticed. So he said, enough of that.
Maybe he'd been testing it right along.
Yeah, I think he had.
How much can these old squares take?
Right. And that, you know, the length of hair, I never could understand that preoccupation with how long your hair was, because what difference does it make?
It did affect our relationship a little bit with the some members of the city council during that time. They had, most of the council was, well, I think all councils are pretty straight, but they had two very straight councilmen, George Wickham and Bob Andreessen, and they just couldn't stand Andreessen at all, and were fairly vocal about it. And one of the wives would get me on the phone and raise hell about Andreessen. And I do think it made a little difference in our relationship at that time, I think now it's probably.
Well, they didn't like Leonard at all, because he was a good reporter, and he would take down their quotes verbatim. Well, then they don't like to see what they actually said in the paper, and they'd always accuse him of misquoting them, but he really didn't.
Well, that's when he started doing it. They come up to me, well, one particularly in Rotary, and say, hey, misquoted again. So I'd come back and tell Andreessen, because I wasn't. I used to cover the council myself, but in later years I don't. And he said, well, I'll take it verbatim. That's what they want.
Did he do shorthand?
He did his own shorthand.
And most reporters,
lots of newspaper people
yes,
do that.
Bruce Coleman always took his in shorthand. I think Leonard had his own.
At one time, when Joe Sheeks was mayor, they taped it, the whole thing. And you could go back and get the direct quote. But some of the fellows, not that they were inarticulate, but what happens when you're thinking fast, what you say isn't exactly what you had in mind. And so they took the tape out of there.
Well, as newspaper people, you know the problem is getting things out of context.
That's true.
Very seldom does one sentence stand on its own.
That's right.
That's very true.
Yes. It's a big problem.
We have editorially been very fortunate in our staff. Catherine is a marvelous recruiter. She goes pretty much through the state schools, journalism
school.
Stanford, yes.
You mean when you get young people just out of school?
Well, it depends. We've had, Randy Wilson is our fifth managing editor since we've been here, and I'm happy to say that each one of his predecessors has gone on to bigger and better jobs, and this is... We lost two to the IJ. Leonard Andreessen is now head of the Wall Street Journal Wire in Canada. So, anyhow.
But in that line, we don't try to keep them, Carl. It's a disservice to them. We can't pay them enough. And if we did pay enough to satisfy them temporarily, we'd be cutting off their potential for the future.
Better to have a bright young person for 3 years and a hack for 15 years.
Well, that's kind of it, although I don't feel that we've had any hacks.
Well, I don't either, actually.
I know. I think that you want to see a young person succeed, and I would love at this stage in the game to see Randy stay there for the rest of my life. But that, you know, that won't happen, because he's just been marvelous. He's a conscientious reporter. He's a very fine editor. And anyhow, it's not going to happen. But as long as we've got him, I'm
and
grateful.
Has a fine educational background.
The thing about Marin County that wasn't touched on, why should it be? But it's a very desirable place, and a lot of talented people live here and want to live here. So that it's not hard to recruit for a paper here, because you have dozens of willing applicants. And it's not as though you're, you know, you're off in the boondock somewhere. So it's, you've got a lot of riches to choose from. And it's, I just wish we could get more of them jobs.
Where we have a tough time recruiting is in advertising department. And the reason for that is that the field is hard to supply enough talent. A kid coming out of school, when I say school, I mean college, and with any kind of an advertising degree or business, he can go to the Mets right away, and with substantial money, which the small town can't do. So I don't know whether the now people would appreciate this, but we have more success with women because they are willing to work for lesser money and like a town like Mill Valley. I think that's true in lots of the small papers, of which we have several now in Marin County. They're having lots of success with women. And their money's up there now, too, pretty good. But not like the Mets. I say Mets, I mean Metropolitan.
Sure, right. Well, it's different being in a metropolitan area like this, too, where I suppose a lot of your subscribers may take 2, 3, 4 papers.
Yes, that's true.
That's different than if you're in Green River, Wyoming.
Oh, yeah.
That's true. That's very true. The well, as also for the matter of record, I feel we've been, the record has been part of the community, and we've been pleased to support some very important projects. The library is one, which we supported thoroughly. The school is another. There's been a lot of controversy about that school, but the original concept, and if they can ever, the city and the school can ever get their acts together, it still is an important concept of joint development of that property down there. Neither one of them can really afford it, and everybody uses it, so why shouldn't they jointly develop it? But
give us just a little background for the record on that.
There is an area around the middle school that was used to be called Project 17 acres. It was owned by the city. The school district needed to build a new middle school. How much acres did they buy? Is it 3.2 acres or 4 acres or something like that on the corner there of Camino Alto and Sycamore. The idea was that the playing fields and the area used outdoor area would be jointly developed by the city and the school district in terms of building it, grassing it, maintaining it, and there would be a division of responsibility, but so that the city could use it and the school district could use it. Well, now that has come down to a point where they have 400 kids signed up for a soccer team, and they were to re-turf the ball field and have that ready this summer or by fall, but the negotiations between the city manager and the school district superintendent have dragged out to such an extent that it's now too late to do the seeding and the turfing. And it appears to be, they might deny this, but it appears to be a conflict of personalities as much as it is a conflict of financial problems. Because now, you know, this field won't go forward until next year, if then. So it was a good concept, and it was back in the several city councils ago. The public safety building is another example of what one, you know, where you, the premise of that public safety building, which is across the marshland from the middle school, was that it would be, in order to finance it, in order to pass the bond issue to build that, it would be built on city-owned property, Well, that was the only property that the city owned that was big enough to take a building. And I think it was Ed Bosenegger, who was a city councilman, that kept saying, you better get that Sycamore extension in first before you build a building. Everybody went under the assumption, and it was seemed a logical assumption at the time, that of course the Sycamore extension would be built. It was engineered to be built across that marshland. Well, it is, you know, we know what happened to that. It still isn't built. So the public safety building.
Well, there was a referendum on it, and
And actually, the school district owned that property over there, and they traded with the city in order to six. I don't know how many acres. I can't remember if I can check on that.
That's the sequence of it. Right?
Yeah, they traded their property over there with the city, so that the city would have that, and then the school district would have all this land of Project 17, which would be jointly developed. And the question that I have, and that I don't think there is an answer to, is how can one city council making decisions bind the future city council to carry those decisions out? And I guess there is no way. Because this is...
Well, that's a gray area. The courts have fought that one. Yeah. I mean, considered that for years. You don't know exactly whether they're buying in or whether they're not.
And it concerns so many things. I know people who are putting up a building very often may get a building permit, and they all of a sudden discover that there's another agency which should have been in on this.
That's true.
And all of a sudden they stop and they don't know where to go. So it's a continuing and bureaucratic problem.
It certainly is.
And then the personnel changing, like you say, it's terrific.
Yes.
But the paper did support the schools and the library.
and the public safety building.
And the public safety building.
I get a little criticism, not bad at all, but a little needling. See, they selected me to head up that tax thing they had for that school, middle
tax
school.
Tax increase.
And it was the last tax, you know, you had to take 2/3. And it's the last one that was successful in the county. You couldn't pass a tax bond issue today.
For anything.
Free ice cream would rule.
Yeah. Well, that's a momentary thing. We'll gradually get over that.
No.
Once in a while, I get a little needle that we supported the public safety building. And these are issues that we won in the West. We were part of the thing. Is the size of the building, the public safety building. Some people think it was overambitious, the results were. I think that I've asked Walsh about that, and the reason he put in for the building as big as it is now is that he made a study and an inquiry from people that have gone through this, and almost everyone says the building is obsolete now and it should have made it bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to go through that experience. That's why.
Well, our own City Hall would be an example in the mid-30s. Yeah. Everybody cried their eyes out because of this elaborate, huge building, totally beyond any conceivable needs. And as you well know, they're just adding, $500,000?
Yes.
And that barely takes care of it now.
That's true. They're going
I was looking at the building yesterday, going around the back from the Mill Valley Market. And it's remarkable how they've made that addition look like it's been there for years.
I know it. And it isn't even completed. It's still working. So that's quite a feat.
It certainly is.
One of the things I remember, speaking of newspaper happenings, is that at the plant on East Blythedale, the old hot type plant, when we had all our production self-contained, we used to have school tours. Teachers would bring school children down, and then they'd go through, and they'd get their names on, typed out on little lead slugs and all this. And it went on for years, and little Girl Scouts, little Boy Scouts, little kindergarten, everybody, and everybody was just fine. Then came the looser life of the late 60s and early 70s, and school tours began to take on, you know, they get bigger and less organized. And one day, I think it was the fourth or fifth grade from Old Mill came down with two teachers, and there were about 35 kids. And our plant couldn't handle that many at a time. So I asked if we could take them through in groups of 10, which was a manageable group. So they were out in the front office, you know, milling around and being like little children are. And the teachers had absolutely no control over them, and they broke loose and they went right out into the plant. I was just stunned, and I didn't know what to do, because you're talking about dangerous, you know, machinery. Well, I went out on this little to look over the plant, and here I saw just a sea of little children running around into the press pit. And I thought, oh, you know. So I asked the teachers to, you know, round them up and get them out of here. This is too dangerous. They had no control. So, you know, I brought my scream out. And I never been so scared, though, because the metal, you know, they were casting metal. There was molten lead everywhere. There were saws. And these little wild Indians running around all over the plant. But I talked to the superintendent after that and said, you know, send out a directive. We're happy to have groups, but no more than 10 going through at a time. And that did help, but I'll never forget that.
Carl, I think kind of a human interest part of shows a relationship between a paper and the clients and readers. For years, until Anderson came, our deadlines were almost nil. If somebody came in late, we'd say, sure, we'll get in for it, we'll try it. And we could stop the press and that kind of thing. Well, finally Anderson had been there about 6 months, and he'd had enough of that. And he put down the deadlines. And then people had been used to coming in, you know, and they'd say, well, and then they'd go directly to him and say, not a chance. You missed the deadline. You know, these people were horrified. They hadn't been treated like that, you know, for years. But now they're used to it, and we don't say that. They just, if they missed the deadline, they missed the deadline. But anyways.
You got away from the small town approach to a degree,
right,
at least.
Yeah, right.
But that would be agonizing to have to, in a sense, start over after you'd gotten underway.
Yes, you can't.
Yeah.
You can't do it at all.
With the old flatbed, you could actually take, you know, your forms are flat on the press, and you could actually take a piece of copy out and stick something else back in there. But today, you can't do that.
The sophisticated equipment won't tolerate it.
And you set, pardon me, you set things up now and send them away and have them done.
Yeah.
Where is this printing done now?
We have two operations that we send to Carl. Our paste up and make up, what they call production, is done in Santa Fe at the Northgate Industrial Park there.
Mm-hmm. And that's raw copy goes up there, and they typeset it, and then Randy goes up there each Monday to supervise that. We see all the proofs and all that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still totally under our control. But they do the actual typesetting.
The printing is done in Healdsburg.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well out of the City Union area. What I was wondering is, when things go up there, you say the raw material and so on, does that mean it's in longhand or
no,
type?
No,
type.
It's
type.
Everything
type. The only thing that we do, the only thing that we have at 438 Miller now are people and typewriters. And a Xerox.
Well, it's a lot more efficient in a way,
yeah,
and a lot easier to handle.
And this
isn't
is a pattern all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
This is what there's one printing. Usually, where we're a little bit different is we're farming out our production. Now, most shops do their own production and then send it to the printer and put what we call the paste up.
That's what
get
you,
all the pages.
That's the production you talk about.
Yeah.
The typesetting and the pasting.
We don't do that ourselves.
That's
done.
Mm-hmm.
But in a sense, we're there, two of our people or sometimes three of our people are there during the production, and they enter into that.
Mm-hmm. They supervise.
They
have to okay
everything. So they work together
on
it, in other words.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons for that is that today the typesetting equipment is getting larger and more complex and more expensive. And you could, certainly, a paper of our size could get our, we could have our own production equipment and do our own, but you'd have a lot of excess capacity there. It's done so quickly that your temptation, we don't want to go back into job printing, but Marin Suburban does a lot of job printing. They do our typesetting, they do their own papers typesetting, but they've got all the equipment too. If we were younger, we probably would do it ourselves, but right now.
An interesting point in our negotiations and when we terminated the contract with the union was the flexibility that we asked for, and after further negotiation got, was that after 6 months of termination of contract, we could go back to our own production without union help, which was, everybody was awed at that in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you get that? And of course, the answer was just lucky, we guess, because we don't know why they agreed to that.
Well, they were obviously stunned by the negotiations, during which they discovered there were three people involved.
You know, well, it could have been a factory. Yes.
You'd lose your hold on the thing.
But so, 6 months has long passed, so if we ever did decide to, we would have no problems. But with this, as I said earlier, this happy relationship, we're not toying with that idea at the present.
Well, I used to hear people complain about the record, but I don't anymore. I've been here during, I think, 5 ownerships.
Have you really?
And of course, you people obviously are doing the best job by far. You fit into the community. You're sort of mutually complimentary. And
everybody. Well, it's nice of you to say that, Carl. Appreciate
you never hear anything negative, really, anymore.
Well,
you used to complain all the time.
Right.
And the paper,
well, on
course,
that note, I guess we could probably.
The paper looks good and it reads well and everything. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Carl.
Well, one more thing, Ned. You signal that you have something else you want to say, so we have lots of tape here, so let's go ahead and say it.
All right. Thank you, Carl. What I did want to say was a very significant thing that the record did do within 6 months after we took over was persuade the City Council of Mill Valley to change its meeting nights from Wednesday to Monday. It was very clear right from the outset when we took over that the Wednesday night meeting after our Wednesday morning publication was just not conducive to a good reporting job of the City Council. The council did this with almost no opposition at all, or with no reluctance. They realized, as we did, that the more immediate exposure they could get to the better both the council and the paper could serve the community. And so they did pass it. And we have been grateful ever since. Some of them don't live in Mill Valley anymore, but to the council that time, Mayor Joe Sheeks, the other councilman Bill Secor, Michael Warnham, George Blackwell, and George Minardo. Since that time, no one has ever mentioned that the date should be changed back to Wednesday, and that's where that part stands. Another significant thing that the paper did a little over 10 years ago in a campaign for circulation instead of doing it just for the paper, we did a combination of offering the subscription for 1 year, and the net proceeds of all subscriptions would go to the Marin General Hospital for a use of their designation. This proved very successful to both the paper, which increased its circulation, and to the hospital, which increased revenue for their equipment. Mostly it was in the heart and respiratory areas of the hospital. We have just completed, we completed 10 years of this campaign, and we are now entering into our 11th year. The hospital has been happy with it, and we, of course, have been very happy with it.
Those are welcome additions, Ned. It's nice to have things like that to help keep the record straight. If you'll pardon the expression. Thanks again to both you and Catherine.